Hi everyone, it's Grace. Before we start our episode, I want to tell you about two things. First, the Where the Mountain Meets the Moon trilogy calendar I've been working on is finally out. It's available from the Eric Carle Museum bookstore, and if you purchase a book of mine at the same time, you'll get 10% off. The link is in the show notes. The second thing is that my other podcast, Kids Ask Authors, now has a Patreon page. Even if you don't listen to that podcast, becoming a patron helps this podcast too, since I produce both of them, and support would be greatly appreciated. And if you become a patron of that podcast, there are some really great perks, like the exclusive Random Question podcast only for patrons. On that podcast, I ask authors extremely random questions with always interesting answers. Don't you want to know what food Jason Reynolds can't bring himself to eat? Or what Jacqueline Woodson always buys at the grocery store? Become a patron of Kids Ask Authors to find out. The link is also in the show notes. Thanks so much, and now on to our episode.
Hi, I'm Alvina Ling.
And I'm Grace Lin.
And we're Book Friends Forever.
We're childhood friends that grew up to be
a children's book editor
and an author and illustrator.
Welcome to Book Friends Forever, part two of the Body Positivity and Health at Every Size episode. Every week we catch up with each other's lives, talk about what's on our minds, and share with each other what we're grateful for.
And if you enjoy our podcast, please tell a friend about it and check out our website, bookfriendsforever.com. The website will include more detailed show notes as well as links to the episodes.
And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps with discoverability. And so thank you everyone who has already rated and reviewed our podcast.
So Alvina, how have you been?
Well, I am still on vacation, which is amazing. It's been actually, so today is Labor Day that we're recording this piece. And today's my last day of vacation, which I'm a little bit sad about, but I've had a really amazing time. I feel really lucky to be up here in Vermont. We've gone biking. We went on a 28-mile bike ride up on through Burlington and went hiking up a mountain, went swimming, walking. We've been binge-watching Selling Sunset, which is a terrible reality show on Netflix, but very enjoyable. And I have been doing a little bit of editing, but otherwise I haven't been working and I haven't been on email. So I really have been able to unplug, which has been wonderful.
Well, go back to Selling Sunset. What's that about?
So Selling Sunset is this reality TV show about this realtor, real estate brokerage is in LA, and they sell like multi-million dollar houses in Beverly Hills and the Valley and up in the Hollywood Hills. So it's like, it's kind of like real estate porn. And then at the same time, it's created by the guy who created Laguna Hills and The Hills. So it's kind of that kind of gossipy and lots of drama. And so, you know, all the real estate agents are having various dramas and in their personal life. So it's actually really addictive. So Donna was the first person to recommend it to me. And I kind of was like, I don't know. I don't, you know, if I want to watch that. But then, you know, Stephen and I decided to try it one night, and then we got totally hooked. So I think if you love looking at houses, beautiful houses, and if you kind of want like just a mindless petty drama, then give it a try. It's on Netflix.
Give me an example of some petty drama. I'm just curious because I actually don't watch any TV, so this is so interesting to me.
So let's see. There's a new, a real estate agent who joins the brokerage. Her name is Chriselle. And so then she ends up having like some, you know what? It's funny. Like, I don't even remember. Like, it gets more dramatic where, you know, because they're kind of, you know, one of the women is dating someone who's kind of famous. He's on HGTV. And so they have paparazzi capture them, you know, when they're out and about. And then one of the other realtors makes a crack about how they must be calling the paparazzi to let them know where they are, because the paparazzi doesn't just like show up and they're not following them around. And then she gets really offended. And so it's a lot of people saying, things that offend other ones. I mean, and some of it is real stuff, like, you know, one of the agents was pregnant, but she wasn't telling anyone yet because it was really early. But the new agent kind of let it slip that she was pregnant in front of other people. And, you know, so it's just like petty things like that, like kind of gossiping about each other's lives and relationships. Like one of them is like engaged to like a really, you know, she's like 37 and her boyfriend's 25. And, you know, so people just, you know, gossiping about the relationship. So it's that kind of, it's like high school drama.
It's so funny because those are things, I don't know, those are things that I don't think I would enjoy.
Yeah, it can be kind of infuriating, but then it's also like, I don't know, there's something that's comforting about like, oh, I'm so glad that's not my life in a way, you know, but also like the fashion, you know, everyone is dressed so impeccably and the houses, you know, of course, I love to watch it just to see all the houses and, you know, imagine like, oh, would I buy that place? You know, like, oh, you know, if someone gave it to me, I would live there, you know, that kind of thing. You can just be really judgmental about everything. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily up your alley. But I watch Million Dollar Listing sometimes. Like I'm kind of a, you know, I love all the real estate. I know shows.
You love reality TV, like yeah, The Bachelor, like House Hunters, and Bachelor,
Yeah,
yeah, those yeah. are. Those aren't really my kind of thing.
Not your cup of tea.
But
how have you been?
Oh, me. So how have I been? All right. I mean, tired because I'm still trying to adjust my schedule to wake up earlier. I haven't done it successfully yet, but, you know, I think it's a work in progress. Doing all these things to try to get more work done. So I've decided to, like, stop working out in the mornings and I just do like a shorter walk so I can get more work done. And I think in some ways it's really good because I am getting more work done, but it's also sometimes I feel a little depressed about it because I feel like I'm making all these little changes and yet still the painting I'm working on still isn't done yet. It's such a
it's but like, it is the most complicated one, right?
Yes, it's the most complicated one. And like we talked about, like it wasn't going to be life-changing, all these little tweaks. It was just going to be another hour here, another hour there. It wasn't going to be like a whole big gift of time that I'd be getting. So I have to be realistic about that. The other thing that I've been thinking about is the Mulan movie just came out. Did you watch it?
No, I haven't seen it. My brother Ben and sister-in-law Iris watched it. They said it was, you know, it was okay.
So it's really interesting because I have not watched it, but I did read the script. So I'm curious to see what it's going to be like because, you know, I did the Mulan book. So I've been trying to decide what to do to watch it. I thought since I did the Mulan book, what we do is have like a movie night. And so I thought we'd project the Mulan movie onto our, like, the back of our house. And we'd invite a bunch of Hazel's friends over and we'd do it socially distanced. So, like, every family would get a blanket that's like at least 6 feet apart. And, like, when you're on your blanket, you can take your mask off. But when you're off your blanket, you have to put your mask on, you know? And then we're going to also mix it in with the Moon Festival, and we give everybody mooncakes. So it was going to be like this Mulan and mooncake party, and my daughter's really excited for it. But what happened was I mentioned about, like, oh, the movie's coming out, and a reader commented on my Facebook page about the boycott Mulan controversy, I guess because the actress of Mulan came out and basically...
She spoke out against the protesters in Hong Kong.
Yes. So I was like, it's anti-democracy. That's what it is. she's anti-protesters and anti-democracy. And it was pretty bad. I feel like what she said, she was like saying, shame on the protesters. I completely support the police. That's what she was saying. And so they're having this big boycott Mulan thing. And of course, the reader was like, well, you know, how do you feel about that? And I had to really think about it because I feel like I have a very... I kind of have a slightly vested interest with my book, you know, like with the hope that if the movie does well, then maybe my book will do well. So I had to like really think like, how do I really feel if I could separate like my book from it and all those things. But I think what I came down to was, like, I still feel like there's not enough Asian representation in media, especially in Hollywood movies. And I kind of feel like I think I still want to watch the movie, if only just to support Asian faces on screen, because I feel like we're still at that point where if an Asian-led movie fails, I think studios are still like, oh, people don't want Asian movies. You know, Asian stories don't sell, you know, that kind of thing, especially right. I just feel like right now, especially too, with the quote unquote Chinese virus, you know? Right.
I mean, but also, like, she's one person. I mean, there's thousands of people who are involved in making this movie.
Yeah.
So should, you know, the words of one and the opinions of one person involved really cause people to boycott the whole movie? You know, to me that seems, I mean, even when we're talking about the kind of Me Too issues, like, you know, when you talk about, like, well, should you boycott all Harvey Weinstein movies now? But there's so many more people who you know, were involved in creating that art. So I don't know. I'm torn in that way.
I guess I just feel like the truth is I think I have a double standard, because I was thinking about, like, Mel Gibson. Like, I will not watch a Mel Gibson movie, you know, because I feel like he's said some horrific things and I don't want to support that because I don't really want him to have another movie. But I kind of feel like, you know, there's no danger of them not making any more white male movies, right? You know, whereas I seriously do think that there's a danger of them not making more Asian movies if an Asian movie fails, and that's how I feel. And so I don't know. So I in my response to the reader, I was like, is there a way that we can still support Hong Kong democracy and still watch, you know, and still support Asian representation in the media? You know, like, can't we give to a group that supports Hong Kong democracy instead of boycotting, like giving instead of withholding, you know? Mm-hmm. Because I also don't think that if Mulan fails, I don't think Disney's going to be like, oh, it's because of boycott Mulan, right? and we better do something to help Hong Kong. Like, I don't think it will do anything to help the cause. That's kind of where I came down to. So so that's kind of where my thought process came, though I still have a lot of people on my Facebook page saying, like, boycott Mulan, and I do have a couple people, friends in Hong Kong, who are like, no, don't do it. Like, don't watch it. Like, don't support her. And I completely understand that. So, like, I am still kind of a little bit, like, trying to figure out what to do. But anyway, to make a long story short, so I was trying to figure out whether or not we should show the movie, and my daughter's like, that movie looks too scary. Let's just watch the cartoon. So we're just going to show the 1998 cartoon Mulan movie anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, I have heard that, yes, that there are some scary parts. And also because I guess they took all the music out and I guess some of the comic relief out, it is more serious than the original. So, you know, maybe that's the right call.
Yeah. Though I feel like I'm going to have to, because there's so many inaccuracies in the Mulan animation. I'm like, is it okay if I stand up before we talk, before we show it, and I say, some things are not accurate in here, just let you know, or something like that. Like,
yeah,
some things are just so.
Yeah, of course you can. It's your party.
I was saying this to my daughter, and she's like, she was like, just don't make it too long of a speech.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been really interesting to see the response of the movie, because I think a lot of people are criticizing it because it was written by white authors, white writers, and not Chinese writers, and because of that there are inaccuracies apparently with this movie as well. But it's interesting to kind of see the different points of view. But, you know, hey,
I think it wasn't, at least from the script I read, I didn't think it was that bad. I mean, they definitely took some artistic liberties, you know, but I felt like at least they're Chinese, they had a lot of I guess it would be the equivalent of sensitivity readers, right? they had a whole slew of them, at least from what I saw.
Right, so the whole cast is Chinese. So, yeah, but so you know, I guess vetting. What I saw was like had to do somewhat with the inscriptions on the sword and, you know, things like that that might not necessarily be in the script. But
oh, okay. Like the imagery. Yeah, I'm not sure about that. But in the script, I thought that it seemed okay. But like I said, I haven't seen it yet. So I guess I still have to decide whether or not to see it. I probably will, but maybe I'll wait until it doesn't give more money. I don't know. But does it matter? Like, you know, like, I don't know.
I know. It's hard to make. Well, but at least you don't have to decide right now.
Yeah.
And you can tell people, well, buy your book instead of watching the movie if they want to boycott the movie and not support that actress.
That's what I was saying. I was like, well, even if you don't watch the movie, you could still buy my book. Yahoo! So we'll see. Anyway, so that's what's been going on for me this week.
Great. And now here is part two of the Body Positivity and Health at Every Size episode.
Well, that's really interesting when you talk about the internal critical voice. Just to put it in kind of very personal terms for our listeners. Can you like walk us through like questions or things so here, I'll give an example. So like the other, like, 3 or 4 weeks ago, I did this recording for the Eric Carle Museum, and they sent me the recording back. And when I saw it, I was so kind of shocked to see what I look like. And I was remember thinking like, oh gosh, I've gained a lot of weight. I look really fat. You know, like that's the first thing. So, what would you? And I think that that happens to many people, especially women, right? What kind of story do you think we should start telling ourselves when that hits us?
Yeah. I mean, I think I know for me, and I want to say, like, I have those thoughts all the time. Like, I'm deep in this practice and learning all this stuff, but I have those thoughts all the time. And I think it really is fat phobia rearing its ugly head. And so I think for me, when I have those thoughts, I first try and really kind of just sit with them and feel the discomfort and let myself feel my feelings, you know, feel whatever fear or judgment or grief I'm experiencing and kind of distill it down into, like, you know, what are these most basic feelings? And then I kind of try and say, like, who gave me these feelings? You know, and kind of go through different steps of, like, the ways in which our culture has taught me to, you know, see, like, okay, you know, I look fat, I'm fat, you know, and then just kind of be like, and why is that bad? You know, what has taught me that that is a bad thing? Why do I feel uncomfortable with this? You know, what media, what about our culture has made me feel really uncomfortable with this and has associated being fat with a negative thing. And so I just mostly try really hard to take my discomfort and let myself feel my feelings, but reflect it back on the culture. Because I think, you know, what happened a lot when I was kind of in the throes of more like pop body positivity is that I would often just feel like I was failing at being positive about my body. Like, I'd be like, oh, like, the problem is that you're just not being positive enough, and you're just not loving yourself enough, and you're just not trying hard enough to accept yourself. And what I appreciate about fat liberation versus body positivity is that it says, like, wow, it is so understandable that you would have this reaction based on a way that you feel your body might have changed. But isn't that messed up? And who gave you that reaction? And what are some ways that you can, you know, fight this culture and be compassionate with yourself and gentle with yourself, but also try really hard to combat the larger system that has given you these thoughts? And like I was saying earlier, too, like, investigate, like, who does having these thoughts really negatively impact at the end of the day, you know? And I think especially if you're thin, or if you're like me, who's a small fat person, you know, I am on the lower end of the fat spectrum. I'm a small fat person. And so I really have to focus too on like, who is it harming when I have negative thoughts about my own weight gain? Ultimately, it's harming bodies bigger than mine. And so I think that's a really important thing to do, is kind of center and acknowledge your own thin privilege in things, and stay focused on, you know, the ways that having these ideas about being thin is being more beautiful, and, you know, I look wrong, I look different, I don't look like myself, I look bad, you know, how does that hurt people who really are fat, you know? And I think that's kind of the thing I really try and stay focused on. But it's hard. I want to say that. Like, it's really hard. And I have days where I'm just like, feel so crappy about myself, you know?
I think it's great that you're pointing out to think of that the harm is to the bodies larger than yours. Because my I don't want to say go-to, but my reaction has always been like, if I continue thinking this way, it's harming my daughter. You know, like I keep thinking like, I'm going to reinforce this idea that she has to be a certain way, like look a certain way. And I don't want her to get that from me in any like sense of the word, in any sense. I have to admit, I have not really taken the one step further, realizing that the harm hurts the people that are larger. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I really appreciated when I was listening to your episode about how conscious you were thinking about your daughter, because I do think it's important to think about also the ways that it is harming her and her own views on other people's bodies, you know, like the way that you might be inadvertently reinforcing weight stigma and fat phobia, you know, like it might be giving her own fears about, you know, her own body or her peers' bodies. And those are all being reinforced by culture. So I really appreciate that you were kind of holding that as a consciousness. And even though it is important to kind of focus on the groups being the most harmed by this, I think it's also important, you know, to think about how this is affecting her and how this is affecting her viewpoint and how she's going to treat not just herself, but other people.
So since we're all in children's books, and we're actually, I feel like that we are kind of, as children's book creators, you know, we kind of have a hand in kind of creating society. So how has all of this affected your work?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, I think, like, because The Blue House, which is my most recent book, it, like, only features two thin men. but, you know, I think, like, I feel like because books are kind of behind on where I have been at, like, it hasn't really shown up in my children's books yet that much. Because, of course, all my books that are coming out now are, like, were made years ago. I mean, I definitely think, like, my character in Backyard Fairies was kind of, like, a stockier, chubbier character. And definitely the character in my book I'm working on now, which is called Little Witch Hazel, is...
That's my daughter's name, so that's why.
Oh, awesome. Oh, I love that name. It's one of my faves. She is, like, you know, I would call her, like, a chubby or small fat character, you know, with a body kind of similar to my own. And so I do think it's really changed kind of my approach to character design. And I think, you know, with the conversation about diversity in books, and, you know, there's so much, I think, like, stop and go, am I doing it right or am I doing it wrong from white creators, you know, kind of being like, do I make my books diverse or do I not? And, you know, like, I've definitely struggled with some of those questions before, you know, like, whose place is it, you know, for me to do this or not? But then kind of thinking about, like, well, diversity is this really broad thing. And like, what points of diversity can I bring to the table that are personal for me, that might be, you know, increasing representation that I wish I had when I was a kid that aren't telling someone else's story. So I think for me, you know, bringing body diversity into my books is becoming increasingly important, because it feels like this way that I can, you know, create things for kids who really do need to see themselves in a pages in a way that's meaningful for me and not, you know, kind of co-opting someone else's life.
So how would you suggest to other authors and illustrators how to incorporate body positivity in their books. I mean, this is kind of a, because I mean, what I'm trying to get in terms of, you know, we talk about this in terms of diversity and race, you know, and how I feel very strongly that we definitely want to include other races in the books, but we also don't want to tell somebody else's story.
I mean, honestly, because of the way that books and media have looked so far, one of the biggest ways is just thinking critically about your designs for characters that are kind of coded with these vices, you know, like think really critically about why you might be designing a character that's like greedy or that's like a baker, a jolly baker, or mean or lazy, you know, like why maybe you're designing them as fat. Like, I think this really kind of starting to interrogate and think critically about choices that we make that are so subconsciously influenced by fatphobic culture is, I think, really one of the most important ways. And then beyond that, I really think, you know, I talked about this a lot in my article of like, try doing character design exercises and making characters who maybe in your mind are just kind of like thin by default fat, and see what feelings that brings up and see what ways that you feel like it automatically changes who they are and their, you know, kind of like moral positioning in the story. Because I think, you know, that can be a really interesting exercise, is like, and kind of like a good way to kind of combat some of your own fat phobia, you know, that we all carry with us because of this culture. So I think really thinking critically and kind of experimenting with making your characters fat when you feel like they're just like, oh, they're just like a neutral character, you know, like, because I think, you know, like we see with white characters being the neutral or like the default, that, you know, that's really problematic. And I think having a thin body always be the default is just as problematic. And just incorporating fat characters who are just kind of fat, and that's the least interesting thing about them, you know, like they're living happy lives, they're living their lives, they're minding their own business, they're just doing their thing, you know, they're not, they don't fall into these like stereotypes or tropes. They're like just allowed to exist.
A sitcom where like the overweight or the fat character is trying to lose weight, or
yeah, exactly, you know, or
like the feel like there's a stereotype of the funny fat friend, right? You know,
yep, yeah, or like we see on TV a lot. I mean, you know, obviously not really as much in children's books, but you know, like the kind of over sexualized fat woman who's like seen as very like aggressive, you know, like that's also a trope we see a lot, and it's. Or like the diva, like the opera diva, or the baker, or, you know, like the mother or grandmother, like a strega nona with like a big bosom, you know. So kind of being like, does this character fall into any of these tropes? And how can I turn a character that maybe is just a totally more neutral background character, or character that doesn't have any of this kind of negative or questionable coding, and make them fat and see how that changes it for you, and kind of sit with the discomfort if it changes it in a way that, you know, makes you feel kind of strange.
Do you have a favorite? Have a favorite fat character in media that you would point to as this is a good example of what to do?
You know, it's really hard. When I was thinking about the SCBWI article and writing that, I like really couldn't think of very many. You know, the closest character I got to was like Eloise, but she, you know, I don't know if she's really fat. She has like a big round tummy, and she definitely is also kind of coded with some vices. Like she's, you know, kind of like bratty and spoiled and mean and, but I think, you know, there have been some really awesome books that have come out more recently, like the book Abigail the Whale is one I mentioned in my article, that is definitely like a lot more of a body positive book than we've usually seen. And another book came out recently, Fry Bread by Juana Martinez Neal, and I'm blanking out on the author or illustrator. But there's definitely fat bodies in that book, and they're just there. And it doesn't feel like this thing that's kind of like, oh, that body is telling us something about who this person is. So I'm sure there's other things, but I feel like I'm like totally blanking out on what they are.
Right. And Fry Bread, I wanted to look it up, but Fry Bread is by Kevin Noble Mylard and illustrated by Juana Martinez.
Yes. Awesome.
I love her work.
Yes, me too. Book.
Okay, so I thought we would do, because we've been talking a while, I just wanted to make sure that we don't take too much of your time, but I also wanted to kind of shift and talk about just your work, a little bit away from the body positivity, and just about your, because I know that like both Alvina and I are big fans of your work, and I know that you have a store and all those things, and I'm just like fascinated with how this worked for you and how you were able to get this all done. I think a lot of illustrators are like, wow, she has a store, she has her products, how did she do that? So do you think, I know we both went to the Rhode Island School of Design. I graduated much earlier than you. I won't say how much earlier. But so why don't you just tell me a little bit of what happened after you graduated from RISD?
Yeah. Well, so I graduated in 2013, and I launched pretty quickly into writing and illustrating my first book, Sonia's Chickens, because that was kind of a project that I worked on at RISD a little bit, and then got picked up by Tundra Books right after I left. So I was really lucky for illustration to actually be my job when I left school. And I had kind of, when I was still in school, been selling art prints a little bit while I was in school, because I'd been freelancing for a small magazine called Taproot Magazine while I was in school. And that had kind of created this tiny amount of demand for people being like, we want prints of your work. Aww. So that was really how it began. And then I think I went from prints to note cards after I graduated.
And you printed these yourself and everything?
You know, I didn't. I worked with a printer here in Bellingham, who was just like some friend of my dad's with a archival Epson printer. And I would just like email him my files and he would print them for me. And I think when I was in college, like my mom would send them out. Like the Etsy orders would come in and I would send them to my mom and she would like ship them out for me, which was super sweet.
But you didn't license them. I guess that's what I meant. Like,
no. Okay. Yes. I was having someone manufacture them for me locally and with the cards too. And so I moved to Portland shortly after graduating. And when I lived there, I started getting t-shirts printed. And that was kind of, I feel like, when things really started to pick up with the product surface design kind of realm.
Was the t-shirt also a local manufacturer?
It was t-shirts that I think were made in LA, and then that the screen printing shop I was working with had sourced, but they were being printed in Portland.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And so that's kind of when things picked up, and I was selling art prints and cards and t-shirts, and then I did some tote bags, but it was still like pretty small scale. You know,
was it all through Etsy at that point?
It was all through Etsy, and I was, fulfilling, handwriting the names on every package and, you know, sending them from my bedroom in Portland. So it was, like, definitely a pretty small-scale operation. And it wasn't until I moved back to Bellingham, where I'd grown up, that I started working with this small business here called Bison Bookbinding and Letterpress, making stationery and cards and calendars. And that's, I feel like, when things really started picking up, and they were doing stationery for me, and I started doing tons of other products, just like tea towels and bandanas and more t-shirts, and I started making mugs, and then I had to hire an assistant because I was like, oh my God, I can't do all of this myself.
And it was this is all still through Etsy, or was it?
That was all still through Etsy. And then finally in 2017, I think I switched over to Shopify and built my own site because I'd kind of outgrown Etsy's capacity. I mean, lots of people still work on it, but I think I wanted to be able to customize things and organize things more. And so I switched over to my own website, and that's where I've been ever since. And I've kind of just been expanding every year. Like, I bought a house, and then I moved the business into my attic, and then it outgrew my attic. And so I got a storefront, and then we kind of outgrew that storefront. And now I've kind of merged with my collaborators, Bison Bookbinding and Letterpress. And I'm actually, Carly, who owns Bison, is joining me as my business partner, because it's kind of reached this point where I'm like, I can't do all this by myself. I can't manage all this myself. I want to just make the art, and I want someone else to do all of the business stuff.
Grace, are you still there?
Okay, I'm still here. Is Phoebe, are you still there?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Last thing I heard was that you just wanted to make the art.
Yes, yeah. That's where I ended, is that I was getting burnt out on the business stuff, so I've gotten to this point where I'm kind of expanding my team.
So when you were growing and growing, were you growing just through word of mouth, people just finding you off of Etsy, like, or was it still through Taproot, or was it through the local business that you were? Where do you think your growth was? What was causing your growth?
I think most of the growth is coming from Instagram, but of course, I think most of the growth on Instagram was coming from, I think, working with Taproot and starting to have my books come out. Mm. And Instagram kind of felt like this thing that just ran away with itself. And I still don't really understand. Like, everyone's like, how did you get so many followers? And I'm like, I have no idea. Like, I've never really put, which is a huge privilege, I've never really put that much time and energy into like expanding my following. I've just kind of done my work and posted it there, and the following has kind of happened. But that, I think, is definitely what, I mean, and I know it statistically, we can see where the traffic is coming from, and most of it is driven by folks clicking over to my shop from Instagram. Mm,
so it's a testament to how beautiful your work is.
Oh, thanks.
So I have to admit, I'm completely enamored with your mugs, your enamel mugs.
Oh, thanks.
So where do you get those made, and what's the process of that?
I work with a small company based in Poland, and they're super sweet. And I really was just kind of Googling around, like, because I think a lot of my products, to kind of backtrack a little bit, are kind of born from this, like, idea of, like, kind of seeing old things or things that I find beautiful and cool and being like, how could I make this myself? Mm-hmm. Or like, that would be fun to make. And so, like, I love like old enamelware that I find at thrift stores and stuff like that. And so I kind of was like, I wonder if people still even make enamel mugs with designs on them, because most of the time when you see them with really intricate designs, they're old, and like, mm-hmm. a lot of them are made in the old Soviet Union, which I think is really interesting. And so I was Googling like enamel mugs printed on designs, and it took me a while, but I ended up stumbling across this company, Imalco, who I've been working with for a long time. And they're super sweet, and it's like a small family run business. And it was kind of an experiment. Like, I had my first mug made through them, and I really didn't know what it was going to turn out like. They don't really do samples. And so it was a little bit of a shot in the dark and a risk. But with every mug I've made, I think it turns out a little bit better and a little bit better, because I get more and more intimate with kind of like the way that their process is going to work. And so the way that their process does work is that I send them a vector. They have my file printed on basically a ceramic decal printer. So if you've ever done ceramics and used decals, it's basically the same process, but on ceramic coated steel. So it starts with a steel form that's dipped in a ceramic glaze and fired on, baked on to the metal form. And then a decal is applied and fired on.
Ooh, it's so cool. I really love them. I love them so much.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
Thank you.
But now you have a like brick and mortar store. How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, it kind of happened because we outgrew my attic, which is where me and my employee were sending everything out of. And I have an attic that's kind of like up these steep little stairs. And we were like carrying these giant boxes up these tiny stairs. And then we'd package everything up and carry everything back down. And my sunroom was always just full of like hundreds of packages that USPS needed to pick up. And so I was kind of like, it's time to get this out of my house. I'm tired of my partner and stepson being subjected to like boxes being everywhere and USPS always coming by and my employee kind of tromping in and out. And so I found this little storefront in downtown Bellingham that had lots of space in the back that we could fulfill out of. And so that was kind of my primary thing I was looking for, was we need to move our online fulfillment. And I'd kind of had always like a vague dream of having like a brick and mortar storefront to sell things in, but it seemed always like a far off thing. But because this space had room for it, I was kind of like, well, now's the time because I have this space. So why not? And so it was kind of just this fluky moment of huge growth, and I hired a second employee to run the front of the shop. And it's been really fun to kind of be able to support other artists and people doing similar things to me through being able to just buy their work wholesale. Like, that kind of feels to me like one of the biggest gifts of having the privilege of having a successful business, is like being able to take that money and invest it in supporting other people and showing the world their work, as well as, you know, having this kind of home for my work to exist in, where people can see it in a physical space and it can be accompanied by all these other, you know, products and items that kind of flesh out my world and my vision. So it's been really cool. We just moved and we've been closed during the pandemic. So it's kind of chaos now, but
how has it been during the pandemic?
You know, it's been okay. I think I was in a really lucky position of like, we had a lot of, like money we'd made from the holidays last year that I hadn't spent on any products yet when the pandemic hit. And so I was able to kind of like lock down and just be like, okay, I'm just going to focus on paying myself and paying my employees and like not, you know, we shut down the storefront. We shut down the online store even for a long time, because in Washington we had a, you know, a non-essential businesses shouldn't be operating kind of lockdown.
Oh, even, and, you know, even mailing.
Yeah. And even though we maybe could have gotten away with it, I was like, ethically, I just don't really want my employees to have to come in and put themselves at risk. So we shut everything down. And it was okay. I mean, we totally are getting through, but moving was kind of a part of that, because combining with Bison, my letterpress collaborators, makes it so that, you know, we're only paying rent on one space versus two. And we're kind of consolidating resources, and space. And, so I think that's been a big part of it, is kind of being like, we're going to take this time to kind of actually dream into ways that we can be more efficient and kind of rebuild. We're rebuilding the website. We're coming up with entirely new systems, and kind of slowly sustain ourselves. But we've been lucky to get, I got a PPP loan, and that was enormously helpful to pay payroll for all of us for a little while. And we got another like small business loan that really helped. So we've been really lucky that we've kind of just been able to like go into hibernation and survive.
Well, hopefully all of our listeners will go and look it up. And
yes, thank and you. Then yeah, we're back open.
You'll be,
now. Our online
you'll be inundated.
Yes. Yeah, we're having a big sale right now to get rid of old stuff. So
great. Well, thank you so much. This was such a great conversation, and I feel like I've learned a lot, and you've opened my eyes to a lot of different issues. So, yeah, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate being here. And
now we'll end, as we always do, with what we're grateful for. So I'll start this week. Gosh, you know, I'm grateful for a lot, but I'm just going to talk about one thing this week. On Friday, a movie launched on Netflix called All Together Now, and it's a movie that's based on a young adult novel that I had edited, gosh, about, I think, over 10 years ago, called Sorta Like a Rockstar by Matthew Quick. And to be honest, you know, a lot of my books have been optioned, of course, but this is actually the first book that I personally acquired and edited that has become a movie, like an actual movie. And so I was just really excited to watch it. It stars Aulili Cravalho, who was the voice of Moana. And also Carol Burnett is in it, Fred Armisen. It's a really great cast. And I really didn't know what to expect, because the author and agent told me that they had changed it a lot. And they did change a lot, but they also kept a lot the same. And it was just really beautiful. And, you know, I mentioned last week that I'm here in Vermont with my partner, Stephen, and his father. And they have a nightly ritual where they watch a movie every night at 7 p.m. So basically from 7 to 9, they watch a different movie. And so I had suggested that we watch All Together Now, All Together. And we did. And they really enjoyed it. And, you know, and then actually the next night, we were talking about Moana, and Stephen's father had not seen Moana, so we watched Moana on Saturday night, and it was just a nice kind of feeling of togetherness. So I'm grateful that the movie All Together Now exists, and Aulili was amazing. She really is a revelation. So I recommend everyone go see the movie and also read the book, Sort of Like a Rockstar, which we did do a media tie-in edition called All Together Now. So check it out. Aww. Grace, what are you grateful for?
Let's see. What am I grateful for? I'm grateful that I might have a pod, but I won't go too much of that because maybe I won't jinx myself there. I'm grateful that I'm painting now, finally. But what I'm most grateful for is that the weather is finally cooler. I mean, that has actually made a big difference. Oh my gosh, it was like I thought, like just as recent as a week ago, you know, I was still dying of the heat. But now it's like really cooled down. Like I actually can put on like long pants when I go for a walk in the morning. Like I go for a walk in the morning, like at six or so, like or really early, and it's actually cool and I can put on long pants and I'm like, this is amazing. And
I know, I wore a sweater last week and I thought, wow, it's August and I'm wearing a sweater.
But I love it. I mean, honestly, like we're outside all the time because that's what's the safest thing because of COVID, but being outside with them, it's just so much easier when you're not dying of heat. So that is what I am grateful for. So Phoebe, what are you grateful for?
Oh my gosh, so much. I mean, I think really the first thing that comes to mind is that I'm just really grateful to be here. I really appreciate you guys having me on. It's a total honor. And I do think, you know, it takes a bit of humility and courage to kind of be like, we messed up and will you be on our show? So I think I really appreciate that you guys just were willing to have this conversation and were willing to listen to the person who wrote in. So I'm happy to be here. Thank you. And other than that, I think I'm just really grateful to have work that I'm passionate about, you know, during the pandemic that's, you know, relatively stable and a safe place to live and, you know, that all my loved ones are remaining safe from everything going on right now. So, yeah, I think those are the main things I'm grateful for right now.
And now here's our 2-minute book review segment featuring Allison Morris, the Senior Director of Title Selection at First Book.
Hello, book friends. I am continuing my recommendations of graphic novels this week, and I really want to point your attention to a brand new book for teens, and I would also say adults, that is coming out on October 13th. The Magic Fish by Trung Lee Nguyen, and that's Nguyen spelled Nguyen. I'm going to confess, for the first few pages of this book, I wasn't certain it was going to be my cup of tea, but I was so wrong, and I'm so glad. The Magic Fish is the story of a 13-year-old named Tien, who knows he's gay and wants to come out to his immigrant parents, but he struggles with how to do so, in part because their command of the English language is limited, as is his Vietnamese. Many of his most satisfying moments with them are spent reading fairy tales aloud with them, and in this graphic novel, those fairy tales weave themselves into and out of Tien's own realistic story as he makes his way to school each day, connects with his very supportive friends, and those fairy tales reveal surprising connections to Tien's own life and the lives of others in his family with potent effect. This is a deeply affecting, multi-layered, wholly unique book about identity, self-acceptance, family love, and happy endings, inspired by the author's own teenage experiences as a queer American Vietnamese cartoonist. It is a rich, resonant, and I think a true must-read. I hope you'll pre-order a copy of The Magic Fish by Trung Lee Nguyen, and I hope when you read it, you love it as much as I do. I'm Allison Morris. That's Allison L. Morris on Twitter and Kid Lit Girl on Instagram. Thank you for listening and have a great week.
Thanks for joining us. And thanks to Hachette Book Group, Hachette Audio, Little Brown Books for Young Readers, and Alex at Pacey Works Studio for producing and editing this podcast. You can find me at Planet Alvina on Twitter and at Alvina Ling on Instagram. Phoebe, where can people find you?
You can find me at Phoebe Wahl, which is W-A-H-L, on Instagram and Twitter. And I have a Facebook page, too.
And you can find me at Twitter and Instagram at using the handle PaceyLynn there. We love hearing feedback, so keep tagging and messaging us on social media using the hashtag BookFriendsForever or send us a message via our website, BookFriendsForever.com. You can also see more detailed show notes there.
And if you have any suggestions for future topics to cover, please let us know. And of course, please remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And if you like this podcast, please tell a friend about it. I'm Alvina Ling.
And I'm Grace Lynn.
And I'm Phoebe Wall.
Have a great week.
And happy reading!